The Sound of Civil Discourse. Every election year comes the call for civil discourse, but what does that mean exactly? How do we define and apply the word civil, particularly when mud seems to be a weapon of choice? I'm Keith Shortall, and today we'll explore a new initiative from the Maine Council of Churches that advocates for political discussions rooted in, quote, an environment of mutual respect and honesty. Cynics might say politics has little to do with either mutual respect or honesty, but might candidates and their campaign managers dare to take a different tack? Or is the modern political landscape forever to be shaped by the negative ad that observers say is an effective way of swaying public opinion? And we'll ask the question, how can you have civil discourse if you can't even have a discourse? Some campaigns now shun public debates that they don't believe will help them. Civil discourse, the way politics should be? Maine Calling, after this news. From the MPBN studios, I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. With less than 50 days to go until Election Day, candidates and their campaigns will no doubt be turning up the volume on their pitches to earn your vote. Undoubtedly, this will include attack ads and speeches painting opponents as unworthy of being elected dog catcher, let alone state for state or national office. Today we'll hear about an effort to bring a degree of civility back to political campaigns. With me in the studio, Reverend William Barter. He's the executive director of the Maine Council of Churches. Also in the studio with me, Michael Franz. He's an associate professor of government and legal studies at Bowdoin College. And joining us from our Augusta studio, Dan Shea. He's director of the Goldfarb Center for Public Affairs and Civic Engagement at Colby College. As always, of course, we want to hear from you. What should be done to promote civil discourse in politics? The number, 800-399-3566. Again, that's 800-399-3566. Email is talk@mpbn.net. Tweet at Maine Calling, or paste to the Maine Calling, post rather, to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Welcome, all three of you, to Maine Calling.
Thank you.
We'll start with you, Reverend Bill Barter. There was a time when the phrase civil discourse described a type of conversation meant to educate people about sort of the mundane matters of commerce, as opposed to the grander subjects of philosophy or bigger ideas. Now civil discourse is really, though, about connotes respect in the world of political debate. But why don't you define it for us? What do you see as what do we mean by civil discourse?
Well, and I think that that shift in meaning probably goes more to the term civility and where that sort of shakes out in terms of what we call civil discourse. Civil discourse, as we understand it as the council, and I think probably other folks do, is about respect, being respectful toward other people, including those people who oppose us, who don't always hold our same views, or other that have other points of view. Civil discourse would be refraining from personal attacks against people. Even though people have the right to disagree, they don't necessarily have an inherent right to attack one another. To refrain from making statements that characterize other opponents as evil, bad people, and to make sure that the statements we make about other people are true in defense of our own opinions. So honesty would also be part of civil discourse, to value honesty and truth, and to try to find workable solutions for problems rather than to create more problems through our lack of civility. And beyond that, too, to hold others to civility so that for politicians, that might be their surrogates or other folks who support them. For voters, it might be the way that we talk about the political process, about people who don't vote as the same way we do, or about other people's candidates.
I'll play devil's advocate here, and just in the interest of the conversation, some might see this as, hey, you're taking the fun out of politics. There's a perception that in the course of American politics, it's always been a mudslinging, rough and tumble, Red Sox Yankees that was just sort of the general accepted way that this was carried out, and that some people actually like it.
If you don't mind, maybe I'll.
Sure,
Dan. I've done a little. Sure. I was able to do a little bit of research on that issue with some students. And what we found, and I don't want to bore you with the methodology, but what we found is there are peaks and valleys of the sort of nasty vitriol in American politics. That it sort of comes and goes. So on one level, it's accurate to say that we're used to this. It's not beanbags. It's politics is tough stuff in America. But what we've noticed is in the past 20 or 30 years, there hasn't been this decline. It hasn't bounced back to a more civil period. So you're right, it's always been that way. But there's also been periods of sort of calm and sort of regrouping, which we're not seeing in the past few decades. And as I'm sure we'll get to today, there are some real explanations as to why that's happening.
And Michael Franz, this is not just in the course of the campaigns, but in the process of governance itself. And we look at why Olympia Snow cited the reasons that she stepped down from the Senate. She didn't see any change in the horizon, moving away from this polarity that she had said made it virtually impossible or at least very difficult to govern.
Yeah, that's right. And one of the things that Dan's onto something with the historical analysis, one of the things we know about the partisan politics of today is that the ideologies, the two major ideologies, are lining up more perfectly than ever with the two major parties. So whereas in the past, there were conservative Republicans or conservative Democrats and liberal Republicans, they have migrated to each of their respective parties such that the ideologies line up quite nicely with the two parties. And so what that means is that there is a stronger cohesive team on either side. And those cohesive teams view the other side as dangerous to American policymaking and to American elections. And that is contributing to the increasing incivility that we see.
So are you saying that that what we're seeing in and how campaigns are run and how politicians talk and how they run their campaigns is more of a really description of the American electorate than, in other words, it has moved to match what is out there, or has the tenor that's been created polarized people into these two corners?
Yes, on both. The question on what causes what is really a major issue for the political science on this. There's some evidence to suggest that the sorting happened at the elite level first. That after the civil rights era in the 1960s, conservatives moved towards the Republican Party out of the Democratic Party in the South, and that polarization happened at the top and voters responded. But there's also evidence to suggest that the two parties have appealed to respectively liberal and conservative base voters, such that the voters themselves polarizing are what drew the parties apart. Either way, what we end up with today is parties that are farther apart than they've ever been, more cohesive within the party than they've ever been, and each side sees the other side as offering something dangerous.
So, Reverend Barter, how does a group such as yours in that landscape set out to change what appears to be really an entrenched ideology or a polarity of ideologies that even powerful politicians have found difficult to move?
Well, I think that that's a really good question. I'd like to be able to say we'd have it solved in 5 days, but I think that might be unrealistic. The function of the main council of churches, and I think religious groups in general, not just churches, I think mosques and synagogues, all sorts of folks who are people of faith have a role in this. But we really do strive to inspire folks to, our mission statement talks about, uniting in good works to build a culture of justice, compassion, and peace. Our chief role as a council is to educate and to be an ethical voice. The lack of civil discourse smacks of an unethical behavior that we see that we believe has increased greatly over these past generations to the point where I think most voters say, and I'm not the political scientist here, that we're pretty paralyzed by these this polemic, this polarization of voters, and so it makes us less able to deal with things in our society that churches certainly would support, like feeding the hungry and being people of peace and prosperity for folks who are living in poverty. So to that end, you know, educating people about the negative consequences of such an uncivil discourse, that's certainly one way that we go about it. And another way that we do very concretely, the main council of churches, is that we ask folks to sign on to a covenant for civil discourse. We ask candidates to do it. We invite voters to do it. And we ourselves, members of the main council of churches, model that on our council, and we sign that covenant as well, so that people can agree and at least have the language and codify, in a sense, a set of behaviors that are more civil.
So who has signed that of the top of the ticket candidates in this election? Who has signed on?
Well, we have right now out of the 400 and some odd, 430-something, I think, candidates running for all levels of office in the state, we have 105 people that have signed on. Mike Michaud has signed on, as has Elliot Cutler. Shana Bellows has signed on to the covenant, and we've had, you know, other folks have signed on. The best, rather than trust my 60-year-old memory, if people go to maincouncilofchurches.org,
yeah, sorry.
That's all right. But the maincouncilofchurches.org has on our front page an updated list that updates just about every day as to who has signed on. So we have some national candidates, some statewide candidates who have signed on. The candidates for representative as well have signed on. So I would encourage people to go to the website and look at it because it may change today.
Sure, of course.
But there is there are some candidates even for, you know, just for local office who have signed on as well.
800-399-3566, the number to join, 800-399-3566. Dan Shea, of course, candidates could always sign this and actually live up to it and be civil and polite and respectful. But third parties and other forces and interests that are backing their candidacies can just pull out all the stops, no holds barred, and be whatever they want under the current system. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Well, you know, if you don't mind, I'll talk about a couple items that I think are sort of creeping into Maine politics. But when it comes to outside groups, I'm going to have to defer to Michael because that's one of his specializations. And I just want to step on Michael's toes on that. He's done a lot of work on that. But I would add that, you know, the forces of sort of nastiness and vitriol are abundant. A number of media outlets, news outlets, for example, have found that they can make a lot of money by cultivating a smaller but loyal audience. And they create this loyalty by throwing them red meat by creating a crisis, a danger on every issue. Operatives have figured out, for example, that they can raise more money with nasty fundraisers and that they can get people to the polls by really beating up on the other side. So there are a number of forces out there that are pushing against this ethical piece that the Reverend's talking about. But then on top of that, there are these outside groups that maybe I'll defer to Michael to talk about.
Michael?
Yeah, well, that's one of the trends we've noticed in federal elections in the last few years, especially in the wake of the Citizens United decision in 2010, that the role of outside spending in federal elections and now increasingly in state legislative elections is on the rise. And those groups, many of them, do not disclose who their donors are, don't reveal their source of funding. And even if they do, play fast and loose with reporting mandates to either state officials or to federal officials, such that much of the politicking that happens in many close races is happening from organizations that sound great, like, say, the Citizens for American Democracy or the Citizens for a Better Government or something, but who are funded by interests that we don't see. And they have very little accountability. So they can say whatever they want to say. They can do the dirty work in attacking opposition, sowing certain seeds of hate, perhaps, and can be quite successful in doing so. And so one of the things that policymakers and advocates have been hoping for is better disclosure laws in that regard.
And the candidates can, I'll put it this way, get away with this because they can an attack ad will come out which, by all accounts, these things work. That's why there are so many of them, and that's why money is being spent on them, because they do impact public opinion and move numbers. Mm-hmm. But the candidates can say, hey, I had nothing to do with that. while fully embracing and,
you know. Yeah, then there are clear coordination bands that limit what a candidate and a group can do together. But, you know, and there's many complications to this that are worth discussing separately. But one of the things we're increasingly seeing is that many groups are forming to strictly advocate on behalf of candidates. And when you look at who is staffed by those organizations, many of them are former officials affiliated with the candidates they're seeking to promote, ostensibly without coordinating between them. And so that creates a real conflict of interest in many cases, even though there is this coordination band, theoretically, in the law between a group and a candidate. They can't work together, but that doesn't necessarily mean that there's some sort of implicit bargain behind the scenes, or that the group knows exactly what the candidate is going to do because they used to work for that candidate. And so there's lots of things out there that are contributing to this changing discourse.
And this is, excuse me, I'm sorry.
That's all right.
This is a reality that the Maine Council of Churches became aware of in looking at our own Covenant for Civil Discourse, and we have added a new emphasis for folks that sign on to the covenant, specifically asking that voters and candidates disavow statements that violate ethical standards, even if they're not made by the candidate. And so that if a PAC of some sort makes a statement, we expect that a candidate who has signed on to the covenant will disavow that statement and will publicly speak against it and not simply kind of wash their hands and say, well, gee, you know, it's not my bad. So we take that into account as well when we hold people to the covenant.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions. The number to join the conversation is 800-399-3566. Email talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do the Orthopedic Institute of Central Maine, committed to regaining mobility and getting rid of the pain, jointsme.org, and Techport, offering iPad and MacBook service from broken screens to liquid spills. Learn more at techportmaine.com.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Lawrence Wright. His new book is about the peace agreement between Egypt and Israel that was brokered by President Carter at Camp David. Wright is also the author of The Looming Tower, about the history of Al-Qaeda, and Going Clear, Scientology, Hollywood, and the Prison of Belief. Join us.
Join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, promoting civil political discourse. With me in the studio, Michael Franz, Associate Professor of Government and Legal Studies at Bowdoin College. Reverend William Barter is Executive Director of the Maine Council of Churches. In our Augusta studio, Dan Shea, Director of the Goldfarb Center for Public Affairs and Civic Engagement at Colby College. We invite you to join the conversation. The number 800-399-3566. That's 800-399-3566. Email talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. While we are in this effort of promoting civil discourse, I would like to ask, though, how do you do that if there's even reluctance to have a discourse? And by that, I mean there seems to be a trend of late of candidates, of campaigns, of declining to take part in public debates if they don't happen to help the campaign. That is, if they see that whatever the audience is not benefiting them, there's a reluctance or outright refusal to do so. And for disclosure, there are a few of our own debates scheduled for next month at which candidates have still said they're not either not coming or have not confirmed. But Dan Shea, let me go to you first. Is this part of a new trend or just something that is happening, do you think, here in Maine in these particular races?
Well, I don't think it's new. It's a strategic tool that candidates have tried to use. It's not just Maine. There was a big editorial in the New York Times just recently, for example, about how Andrew Cuomo wouldn't debate his primary opponent because he was way ahead in the polls. And I think he thought, why should I do that? And the Times really called him to task. And as I think we should, I think it's basic. I think it's fundamental. It's a core part of a democratic process. The electoral process is to stand in front of your constituents, in front of your voters, and clearly lay out your ideas. And that needs to happen with your opponent there. I think we should call upon our candidates to have debates, respectful, honest debates about the issues. And if they don't do that, we should hold them accountable. I'm really worried about that. I think it's fundamental. I really think debates should happen often.
Michael Franz, is this just the fact that there's a lot at stake and campaigns are out to do one thing and one thing only, and that's win, and they will do whatever it takes to win? And these larger discussions of what the obligations are of running for public office kind of go out the window.
That's true. And there's also, I think, a real fear amongst candidates these days, in line with the growth in partisan media, that the oops moment, to quote one of the most famous debates in history now with Rick Perry, it could come back to hurt you. There is a core group of operatives on either side who are there to parse whatever words you say, to find inconsistencies, to find policy statements that they can use to exploit you. That makes candidates a bit gun shy.
And,
so, yeah,
and if I could piggyback on that just a bit, and that contributes to, I think, what we've seen evolve, particularly in the era of social media and instantaneous communication, is that we have an electorate that is informed more and more by soundbite, and that what makes a democracy function is an informed electorate. And so what happens, I think, when the electorate is not informed, but what we've seen is that going back to Dan's point, that, you know, we need to demand more accountability, is that power seems to be shifting. And so the conversation, rather than being controlled by the electorate, becomes more controlled by the candidate. And with more and more polarization, that happens. The candidate becomes the champion of a polarized position. And then where does the electorate fall? And I think if we're educating the electorate by soundbite, opinions are formed very, very quickly, and however errantly they're formed. And I think one of the myths out there is that we don't have the power to demand, for example, that our candidates are accountable and that they show up for things like debates so that they can have an open and honest conversation.
Dan Shea, are the campaigns rather than, in this case, simply taking a bet that the public outrage over an empty dais on the stage will be less than the dangers of some sort of misstep or downside on the strategic front? That is, it's they'll take the heat as long as they can minimize the potential damage?
Yes. I think that's the answer. I also think that they understand that a very large portion of the electorate, and larger than it's been since we've been doing polling, is already fixed on candidates, right? It used to be at the presidential level through most of since the 1950s, since we've been doing some real systematic polling, about 10% of the electorate would decide on election day. And now that's down to about 2%. So we're really polarized, as Michael has explained. We're fixed. So there is a portion of voters that have not made up their minds. And I think what the gamble is that they're not paying attention, that group, that it'll really upset the other side that you're not at the debate. And your supporters aren't going anywhere anyhow. And then maybe those who haven't made up their minds aren't paying attention. But let me just add one other dimension to this. And that is, I'm not sure that people these days are less informed than they used to be. And maybe Michael can talk a little bit about the information you actually get from negative ads. But I think the real problem is that we're paying attention to an ever narrower spectrum of information, right? So as Cass Sunstein, a social scientist, said, each morning we wake up and we open the Daily Me. That is, we only listen to, watch, and read those news outlets that conform to our existing positions. And that's the problem. We're not getting the other side. And debates, by the way, back to debates, they do give us the other side. You're necessarily exposed to the other side.
Yeah. Let's go to the phones now. Again, the number to join the conversation, 800-399-3566. We'll go to George in Augusta. Hi, George.
Hello.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Yeah, The money that is spent on media that goes into the media bank accounts, I'd like to see that money go back into the state treasury to be used for the next election, for clean election funds.
Which you'd like to see, in other words, money from advertising to TV stations?
Right. Instead of going for media profit, I'd like to see that money go back into the state treasury and be available for the next election.
That's George's. That was what George would like to see.
Well, one of the things that implies, or one of the things that's I think is a fair policy proposal that's out there and that is useful. It probably will go nowhere, but is worth talking more about. Is this notion of free television time for candidates? You know, it's pretty well settled that the government owns the airwaves for broadcast networks and broadcast channels, and that they can they could, as a condition of giving out licenses, mandate that companies provide a certain amount of free time for candidates to advertise their views. Right now, candidates do get a discount on the ads that they buy on broadcast stations and radio, but they're still raising money to pay for those spots. And presumably, if you had a structured set of sort of candidate hours or candidate times where there could be a set of discussions that happen either with candidates there or providing their information where the opponent provides their information, then this would get out into the views of the public, and it would help cut into the cost of the campaigns that are out there.
Of course, the winners here in this season are the TV stations, radio stations, commercial radio stations that
definitely
get a big injection.
And that doesn't solve the problem, presuming, you know, I could wave my hand and do that, of outside spending, because they really do pay an arm and a leg to get their ads on TV in competitive races, because, you know, the local broadcast companies can charge that to outside groups. They're willing to spend it. They can raise as much money as they need to get on the air. The, you know, local affiliates come in and say, well, it's going to cost you five times the normal rate. And those groups say, fine, and we'll pay it. And so everybody's making a lot of money off of this level of vitriol.
1-800-399-3566. Let's go to Belfast and Beverly. Hi, Beverly. Welcome to the program.
Hi there.
Hi.
My question has to do with Common Ground. And it seems that polarized candidates have less and less of that. I work a little bit within a local environmental community. And I've also bumped into a politician, a really famous senator from Oklahoma, who denies that climate change is happening and has written books about it. I'm wondering if we could demand from our politicians that they seek out common ground with each other, because I can't believe that that this one particular senator, whom I know has grandchildren, would want them to breathe filthy air or to drink the spoils in the Dan River in West Virginia. You know, it's we all have common ground somewhere. We love our children. We appreciate a beautiful natural world to some extent. Sting said, I hope the Russians love their children too, in this old song. And I'm wondering if there isn't some mechanism for seeking common ground between these polarized people, so that things get a little more sane, because right now I'm afraid that who knows where we're headed.
Okay, Beverly, thank you. Dan Shea, is there room for common ground in the rough and tumble world of American politics?
Well, Michael touched on it a little earlier, and it's about the nature of polarization these days. First off, more people are aligning to a party than in the past, and it's more ideologically consistent, as Michael pointed out too. But the other piece is that there's disdain now for the other side. There's a really, I think, big, important study just out a few months from the Pew Research Center, which really explored this issue. And what they found was that folks really don't value the other side. They doubt its legitimacy. They're worried that if the other side gets their way, it'll be the downfall of the nation. There's even some questions about whether or not you'd be upset if your kid married someone from the other side of the ideological spectrum. It's a deep, deep polarization, really, and at the core of it is they cannot fathom what the other side is thinking. They can't imagine how they would have those positions, and it happens in both directions. So there is this big gap, this historic gap, in my view. And as as we might wish, I'm not sure that there is that opportunity right now to find those common ground. One real quickly, someone I think really smart suggested that if we paid more attention to local politics and we paid a little less attention to reading the national news, we'd be more apt to find compromise, because we all have to figure out, you know, the school budget and then the plowing and the local issues, that compromise has to be made or the streets don't get cleaned.
I'm sorry not to be optimistic. Yeah, I was going to say, some of the nastiest stuff I see is in local boards and councils, at least where in the neck of the woods that I come from, at least in my observation. But what about this? What about the, I know everyone is pessimistic about the future here, Reverend Barter, but is there a chance that maybe this is a cyclical thing and that the freshly scrubbed faces that are emerging from colleges as we speak represent a new generation that might not be as interested in perpetuating this polarized form of politics and government that we have now?
Well, I think that, as I think was stated earlier in the show, these things do tend to be somewhat cyclical. I think where you would get agreement is that the system is not working the way it is now. People, for example, move out of college with humongous student debt and not too great job prospects and so forth, they see firsthand how polarization may have well paralyzed, the society to the point where it's really going to impact them personally. They're not graduating from college with this this bright, shiny hope that their lives are going to be better now because they have a degree and a student loan to pay. And so I think that as people recognize the negative sequelae, the negative outcomes of a lack of civil discourse, a lack of ability to compromise, to find common ground, as our caller said, there may well be that time when people just say, "Look, enough is enough. We've got to look at what we're doing here. Otherwise, we're just going to continue to have a government that's either shuttered or just not working." So I think the negative consequences, I would hope that enough punishing negative consequences would motivate people to change this yeah. climate.
Michael Franz, there has been this change of where compromise is really seen as weakness, standing your ground and refusing to give in is seen as a symbol of strength and resolve. Mm-hmm. The sort of art of deal making is seems passé, at least right. in the halls of Washington.
Yeah, our culture actually has a couple different strains of expectations on our political leaders that are at odds with one another. And this is what's feeding into that. You know, on the one hand, cutting deals, compromising, finding common ground are all virtues in what we want, and our candidates assert those in their advertisements. But at the same time, some of that is seen as being a sellout. Some of that is seen as not standing behind your principles and your ideals. And so we expect our candidates to both stand behind their principles and their ideals and to compromise. And I think in that particular setting, in a world where there isn't much common ground with the other party, the only real option for you is to stand your ground, because you can't find someone on the other side. If I could say one thing about the young people issue, which is it's always optimistic to think about the next generation. And there is a lot of optimism there. I mean, I teach some great, great college kids. But one of the things we know from the research about younger millennials is that increasingly, although they have high levels, extremely high levels of patriotism and faith and community, is that many millennials, those born between the years 1980 and 2000, 2010 or so, generally view politics as not really worth their time so much as community involvement. And so people are coming to see patriotism in the form of becoming involved with their community, helping out with local food banks and starting nonprofits. And those are wonderful things. But it also means that they're increasingly seeing politics as something to avoid. And I don't think we should foster quite that second piece as well. I think we should foster a belief that politics is a way to solve political problems, and in many ways to solve them more efficiently than in sort of the volunteering side. And if we could get young people to think that way, then maybe we might be able to take that optimism about change and bring it into the political world.
All right, we're going to take another short break. The number 800-399-3566. When we come back, more of your questions and comments. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Revision Energy, now offering Own Your Power loans for solar energy systems. More at revisionenergy.com. Casella, committed to improving Maine's air quality through the conversion of landfill gas to energy. Casella, giving resources new life. And Darling's Audi of Bangor, featuring the new 2015 Audi A3. Audi, committed to uncompromising design at Darling's Audi in Bangor.
Today, I'm declaring a drought emergency in the state of California.
This is California Governor Jerry Brown back in January.
We're facing perhaps the worst drought that California has ever seen.
In the 7 months since, the situation has gotten even worse. This week on Backstory, we explore how past generations have quenched their thirst for water.
Tune in for that Backstory program this afternoon following Maine Calling at 1 o'clock. Every day, you hear messages about local businesses and organizations that provide their financial support to MPBN. They all understand the value of MPBN in our community and have decided to make public radio and television part of their marketing effort. If you would like to learn what these folks already know, please visit mpbn.net and click on Business Support to find information about the value of sponsorship, answers to frequently asked questions, and contact information, or call us at 1-800-884-1717 and ask for Susan Tran. As always, thank you for your support of public broadcasting in Maine.
Welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, thoughts on bringing more civility to our political dialogue. With me in studio, Reverend William Barter, Maine Council of Churches Executive Director, Michael Franz, Associate Professor of Government and Legal Studies at Bowdoin College, and joining us from our Augusta studio, Dan Shea, Director of the Goldfarb Center for Public Affairs and Civic Engagement at Colby College. The number, 800-399-3566. That's 800-399-3566. We should say that the Council of Churches is holding a panel discussion this Thursday, September 18th at 7 p.m., sponsored in conjunction with the Goldfarb Center for Public Affairs and Civic Engagement at Colby College in Waterville. Now, if you can't make that event, we will be recording it for our 1 o'clock public affairs program, Speaking in Maine, and we'll have more details for you on when that program will be broadcast. Let's go back to the phones now and to Orono and Jane. Hi, Jane. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I would like to bring up the fact that our state of Maine has an exemplary politician.
Jane, I can't hear you. If you could speak up just a bit, please.
Okay, how about that?
That's much better. Thank you.
All right. Our state of Maine has an exemplary politician in the form of Senator George Mitchell. He is someone who cannot be refuted, has tried to bridge the gap between one side and the other. And I think that in this patriarchy, that if all of the male politicians would look to him as an example, they wouldn't have to try and reinvent the wheel. And then the second thing is, there are so few women in politics, but the ones who are, you don't generally see an aggressive, horrible discourse. You see some sense of manners, and you see a true caring for the populace. And even though they're thrown into a system that requires them to raise money and fight, they would probably rather be elected and solve the problems of our people.
All right, Jane, let's do one at a time here. Michael Franz, George Mitchell, we were talking during the break as I saw the note about the call. On the one hand, we do hold him up as this thoughtful, measured master of the deal. People talked about him for commissioner of baseball. But on the other hand, there was another sector of cynics who sort of said, he just doesn't have that, the sort of blood sense for major politics like running for president.
Well, I don't know. But at the same time, to talk about Senator Mitchell as an exemplar in that regard is quite amazing, given the fact that he was the Senate Majority Leader in the United States Senate. And when we think about the Senate Majority Leader currently and perhaps the future Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, neither of those incumbents would come anywhere close to getting that sort of level of consensus from voters in terms of being the kind of civil type candidate or kind of civil type of political leader. And so it's quite amazing that the view of George Mitchell could be that strong, given the roles that he played as a partisan in the rough and tumble period of the 1990s. And I think that's a real credit to his political style.
But there is a sense, though, while they were tough, I mean, let's not pretend that they all just sort of, you know, played golf and made deals. I mean, they were tough with each other, but at the end of the day, I think there's a general sense that there was more respect for the institution, even of the Senate, at the time that he was in charge there.
That's right. And I think what's really important is back to this issue of common ground. It takes a bit of education and a bit of thinking and a bit of reflection to see what it is in the other side that has some sort of compelling potential features. So you could be a very liberal Democrat, and it's very important for that liberal Democrat to look at a conservative Republican and see the sincerity of those particular views that they're holding. Now, not all conservative Republicans and not all liberal Democrats are holding sincere views for sincere reasons, but many of them are. And so whether it's a belief in the market or whether it's a belief on the left of government doing good things, if you can see that the other side comes to that debate with some positive view of what their worldview can accomplish, you could disagree with them vehemently, but you can understand that they come to that discussion with the right attitude.
And I want to go back to the phones, but anyone want to take the second part about although all four of us are males here on the panel, but the thoughts about that there are differences between men and women, male and female candidates in terms of their sensibilities about...
Well, there's good research out there about the different types of campaigning styles of male and female candidates. But one of the things that also is recently been studied is the success rate of male and female candidates and whether there are differences between men and women running for office. The presumption is that women face a harder challenge in running for office because of a variety of you know, features of our political culture. And the research that I've seen has suggested that that's not necessarily true, that women can do just as well as men, that men don't view women as any less possible of accomplishing things. They don't view them as less tough or less of a fighter. The real problem is encouraging. The real challenge is encouraging women to run for office, that the more women that run for office, the better they do. And they don't face, although it seems to be the case that they do face an inherent disadvantage, that voters just want to elect oftentimes people to solve problems.
Yeah. Dan, did you want to add something?
Yeah, I would add to that because there is a little bit of research coming out on women leadership in the state legislatures, and they are finding that they are more prone to compromise and finding a middle path. A few states have a high number of women in the state legislature. Washington, for a while, had a majority of women legislators and a majority of women leading committees. And it was a wonderfully efficient legislature. We also know that the women in the Senate were praised for coming together around a debt ceiling. And Susan Collins was at Colby last weekend, and she was speaking about this. They were given the civility award from an organization because they were able to do that. And I think there's some potential in thinking about women bridging the gaps on some of these issues. So I would agree with the caller. I think the style is different, and I think it's very important today.
Yeah.
And one other thing on a news magazine, I don't remember what it was, just a few years ago, I remember a story about all the women in the Senate. I believe this is still true. All of the women in the Senate, regardless of party or ideology, gather for breakfast once a month. Because they are women in the Senate, that's the common denominator, so I think the fact that they're women and that they are a minority and that they have, as women, face some of the same struggles being women, regardless of party, but they have a relationship with one another, and I think on the floor of the Senate that probably holds sway.
Maybe food is the answer here.
Well, maybe it is. we'll have a breakfast for everybody.
let's go to Jeff in Portland. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, how are you?
Good, thanks.
So I used to be a political journalist here in Maine and eventually started my own political consulting company. And I've worked on both sides, especially on issues. And I have to say that I have to disagree with some things I've heard here. I think they're in the political intelligentsia of which your August group belongs. There's a kind of a reluctance to actually speak some hard truth. And one of the absolutely stunning hard truths is that one party in particular, who I work with incidentally in the past, and that's the party on the right, absolutely doesn't like government and wants to see government fail. So it's absolutely 100% in their interest to not compromise, to find the most polarized position. I think the current administration, although I always agree with Obama on everything, but the current administration, I think they really reached out a hand to the right wing, and the right wing slapped it, spit on it, bit it, and then sent it back in a box. The reality is that there's never going to be compromise of any kind because it's not in the interest of the Republican Party. And you know what? I'll give you an example of that. When George Bush and when the economy was tanking and George Bush needed help to save essentially the world economy, he wound up having to go to the Democrats, and at the end of his term, they stepped across the aisle to help him. The Republicans refused, and in point of fact, I think everyone would agree, if the Republicans had the same opportunity to help Obama at the end of his term, they simply wouldn't. And that's a hard truth. You know, guys like Lee Atwater and Karl Rove have set the stage, and it's now simply in the interest of the Republican Party to be as difficult as they can possibly be.
All right, let's let the panel respond. Who wants to go first? Dan?
Because I've actually done some polling on that. At Colby and then the job I was at before at Allegheny College, we did run a series of surveys on civility in American politics, and your caller is right on one level, at least with regard to compromise. Asked in a couple of different ways, essentially about half of Americans favor politicians that will seek compromise solutions. The other half want them to stay true to their policies, to their principles. But when we break that by party, it's essentially the opposite. About 25% of liberal Democrats or Democrats want their politicians to find, or 25% want them to stick close to their principles and not compromise, and 75% of Republicans want their politicians to stick close to their principles and not compromise. So there are some real partisan differences. I think that's, as your caller said, I think that's truthful. I think that's accurate.
Yep.
But
right.
But I would add, but with regard to vitriol and sort of nastiness, I'm not so sure that there is any dramatic policy or partisan differences.
Michael France?
Yeah, and this is in line with a lot of research that suggests what's oftentimes referred to as asymmetric polarization, that you know both sides have diverged, but that the Republicans have become more conservative at a faster rate than the Democrats have become more liberal. And this is up and down sort of the studies in different formats. And it, you know, the caller's also right that, you know, if you're expecting compromise when your cohesive party is for smaller government, then compromising in any way that expands government is not necessarily a compromise. And so when the party is filled with small government conservatives, it's, you know, compromise is that much tougher. But that doesn't mean, in line with Dan's point, that there can't be a civil discourse surrounding that Republicans can't say, or Democrats for that matter, in wanting to expand government and perhaps make tough choices about entitlements, that tough choices need to be made, that sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. I respect what the other side is trying to accomplish. I just disagree with their policy outcomes.
Jeff, I'll let you respond real quickly here before we run out.
Yeah, well, the reality is that while that sounds great, I can tell you that on the ground that's simply not the way it works. That civility would be wonderful, but let's take for example just quickly the example you were given earlier about George Mitchell. Here in Maine, we thought George Mitchell was a terrific guy. He was a statesman. We always talked about him being, you know, potential for president. That maybe the fact that he didn't have that go for the jugular kind of view was a benefit. I traveled around the country, and I can tell you, in other parts of the country, they thought George Mitchell and Ted Kennedy were the same guy. And that was a long time ago. This has been an ongoing situation, and it's not until voters, I one of your earlier callers who was talking about Inhofe in Oklahoma, and how the chairman of the science committee denies global warming and thinks it's a hoax. And then she said, can't we send a message? We can send messages. The message is, every single time we have an election is a message. The problem is, in many parts of the country, we have the message that's getting sent is keep doing the thing that you're doing.
All right. With that, I'm sorry, Jeff, but we ran out of time. I tried to give you as much time as I could. Thank you all for being here. Dan, Michael, William, appreciate your being here today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Glad to do it.
I'm Michael France, Associate Professor of Government and Legal Studies at Bowdoin College, Reverend William Barter, Executive Director of the Maine Council of Churches, and Dan Shea, Director of the Goldfarb Center for Public Affairs and Civic Engagement at Colby College. John Keimel ran the board today. We had additional help from A.J. Higgins and the MPBN web team. And you can find past editions of Maine Calling as well as a link to our podcast by visiting mpbn.net/Maine Calling. You can also find our podcasts on iTunes. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith. Tomorrow on Maine Calling, join host Jennifer Rooks for a Your Vote 2014 interview with first congressional district candidate Isaac Mishuk. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.